Welcome, everybody, to Crystal Kyle and Friends. Today, we're going to be talking to Dave Smith. I will proceed to yell at him for being a libertarian. That is why we invited him on the show. I will berate him repeatedly, and that should be fun.
Tell him you made him like Dennis Prager, actually.
Yes, that's right.
He made you whatever. This is already off to a good start.
I'm a Prager stan. They call me a Prager stan. I'm all about Orthodox Judaism, Zionism, things of that nature.
Yes, indeed. He had a great debate versus Dennis Prager and Bhatia that we enjoyed. And I thought he, in particular, did a fantastic job. Cenk always does a great job in these exchanges. Dave has such a depth of knowledge and was able to communicate things in a way that actually made Dennis Prager just unable to really respond. He was sort of sputtering at points. So excited to talk to him about that. Maybe we'll also talk to him a little bit about libertarianism too. That would be fun.
I'm going to ask him if Prager is as big of an asshole in real life, because I have some information from behind the scenes where somebody was like, this guy's a real fucking prick in real life. And so I want to ask Dave Smith if he got that sense from Prager, because sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes somebody looks like an asshole, you know, on screen, and then in real life, you're like, that person's actually very sweet.
Yeah. Sagar, I won't say what Sagar said because he hasn't made that public. So we'll just ask Dave.
Well, you just outed Sagar as being one of the sources behind the scenes.
I didn't say
that. He actually wasn't my source, to be fair.
I wasn't saying that.
I have a different source. You definitely said that. But all right. A lot of stuff to get to. So before we get into that, we wanted to, I tweeted about this when I first saw it. I know you guys already covered it. I didn't put it in my show from yesterday. But now we're going to talk about it. So Netanyahu released a video. And in the video, he's basically like berating American college kids who are protesting, mm-hmm. calling them anti-Semites, comparing them to Nazis, and imploring Biden and the U.S. government and the various police forces to crack down, do something about this. That's the gist of the video. So before I say any more, we'll watch and then we'll break it down.
What's happening on America's college campuses is horrific. Anti-Semitic mobs have taken over leading universities. They call for the annihilation of Israel. They attack Jewish students. They attack Jewish faculty. This is reminiscent of what happened in German universities in the 1930s. It's unconscionable. It has to be stopped. It has to be condemned, and condemned unequivocally. But that's not what happened. The response of several university presidents was shameful. Now, fortunately, state, local, federal officials, many of them have responded differently, but there has to be more. More has to be done. It has to be done not only because they attack Israel, that's bad enough. Not only because they want to kill Jews wherever they are, that's bad enough. It's also, when you listen to them, it's also because they say not only death to Israel, death to the Jews, but death to America. And this tells us that there's an anti-Semitic surge here that has terrible consequences. We see this exponential rise of anti-Semitism throughout America and throughout Western societies as Israel tries to defend itself against genocidal terrorists. Genocidal terrorists who hide behind civilians. Yet it is Israel that is falsely accused of genocide. Israel that is falsely accused of starvation and all sundry war crimes. It's all one big libel. But that's not new.
Oh my God.
Every single part of that was a fucking lie.
True.
Let's be clear about this.
True.
So why are the protesters out there? It's actually very simple. It's very straightforward. Number one, divest from Israel. These various colleges, these various universities that have different deals with Israel, divest from Israel. That's thing number one. Thing number two is stop the genocide. Both stop Israel committing the genocide and also stop the U.S. from arming and funding Israel as they do the genocide. This is the point of all of the protesters. What these people do is they strawman the opponent. And they act like they're out there saying Hitler was based. That's not at all what happened. Mm-hmm. What they do is they take phrases like from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, and things like intifada. They take those and they twist the meaning as if they're saying kill all Jews. Except I got bad news for Netanyahu. A lot of the people leading the protests are Jewish. Jewish Voice for Peace, a pro-Palestine Jewish group, was banned at Columbia in like mid-October. Did anybody come out then and say, you know what, this is anti-Semitic? This is cracking down on free speech. This is unacceptable. Why are you silencing Jews? Why are you muzzling Jews? They didn't say anything because they don't want that speech. They don't want speech that's critical of Israel and pro-Palestine.
That's right.
And so he goes out there, guys, you're looking at a man who's responsible for 42,510 dead Palestinians. Of those, 38,621 are civilians. 15,780 dead children, 10,091 dead women. And that's to say nothing of the hundreds of thousands of homes that have been bombed, 137 journalists killed, 2 million Palestinians now homeless because they wiped Gaza off of the map, 322 healthcare facilities being bombed. He is responsible for all of that death and devastation and carnage on purpose, and he has the nerve to call college kids Nazis. Look in the fucking mirror. You're the closest thing to a Nazi I've ever seen.
How many deaths on these college campuses from these Nazis?
A whopping.
How many injuries? I mean,
somebody got their eye poked. I heard.
Oh, yeah.
Except that didn't happen.
In the eye. Except right. It was literally someone walked by with a Palestinian flag, and that was fucking it.
Liars.
It's just like, okay, so there are so many layers to this. First of all, the gall of this foreign leader to smear our college kids as Nazis. And by the way, he really doesn't just smear them. He says this is reminiscent of German universities in the 1930s. Oh. So he's effectively comparing all of America to Nazi Germany in the 30s. That's really the comparison he's making here. Shame on every single one of the politicians, Democrats, Republicans, all the way up to Joe Biden, who have bought into this bullshit moral. I shouldn't say bought into, have helped to craft and invent this moral panic and complete smear of these kids, which is now nationwide, right? From New York all the way to California, Texas, all of these campuses, all of the authoritarian crackdown that you're seeing of the sort, you know, these are the sort of things that I was terrified of happening under a Trump. And now here you have Democrats and Republicans signing up for, yes, let's do the authoritarian crackdown. Let's invite the cops into UT Austin and crack heads, even though there aren't even allegations that there was any instance of anti-Semitism, any instance of violence. There isn't even a whiff of that. And they preemptively bring in, you know, including with the encouragement of a foreign leader here, cops to arrest protesters and, by the way, arrest a journalist and throw him on the ground. It's just, I feel like I'm going crazy here. And then to add to that, the fact that there is no bigger villain on the planet right now than Netanyahu.
How many hospitals has he bombed? How many schools has he bombed?
How many universities has he bombed? Like, you want to talk about safety on campus? He has destroyed every university in the Gaza Strip.
Literally every university. They did controlled demolitions of every university in Gaza.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're lecturing us. And let me also say this. Let's say that the protest chants or whatever, let's say they were genuinely offensive. Guess what? We have a First Amendment.
That's right.
And it protects even offensive, in fact, especially offensive speech.
Skokie case. That's right.
So I don't want to hear it. You can be offended. Okay, be offended. That's your right. Be offended. But guess what? In America, we still have the right to say things even that are controversial, even that are uncomfortable, even that are downright offensive, okay? So the gall of these people. And then they would be the same ones the minute Chuck Schumer, remember when he said, hey, Netanyahu, there should be new elections, Netanyahu should go. They'd be the same ones to jump, oh, you should stay out of our domestic politics, you know?
He
like,
said,
we're funding, you, here you come with your hand out. You want us to keep our mouths quiet while you do a genocide and murder some of our people, too. American aid workers murdered in the world's central kitchen, aid workers. And you want us? Ugh, I just can't.
He said, quote, more has to be done. Okay. What constitutes more?
National Guard.
What do you mean? What does that mean? What is more? NYPD already went and cracked some fucking skulls when they shouldn't have even been there, by the way.
I mean, they're calling for another right? Kent State. That's really what that's many of these people are cheering for. That's what they want.
That's the quiet part, Allied. You're right. They're calling for another Kent State. They want the National Guard to come in. They want violence done against these protesters. All the while screaming, it's the protesters who are violent. They're violent. They're violent. Let's attack them first. What are we doing here? What are we doing? This is total police state type stuff. It does remind me of the anti-Vietnam War protests.
Absolutely.
Where in retrospect, everybody and their mother's like, well, obviously the Vietnam War protesters were correct. We were napalming innocent villagers. Landless peasants were being hit with Agent Orange. You had diseases shoot through the roof because of all the weaponry, chemical weapons that we were using. Everybody in retrospect says, you know what? They were right. By the way, people now do that with the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Everybody who is, skeptical. Turns out they were right. Now that's the consensus. You don't think the same fucking thing is going to happen here when you have 42,000 Palestinians who've been killed, hospitals clinics, marketplaces, factories, every kind of civilian infrastructure you can imagine has been bombed. You don't think there's going to come a day 5 years from now, 10 years from now, where everybody looks back and goes, Jesus fucking Christ, what were we thinking? And by the way, all the fucking assholes, what's that guy's name? Something Price? Greg Price
Greg
or
Price,
something?
Yeah.
He's one of these conservative fucking blowhards who doesn't know his ass from his elbow. And he's out there cheering on Texas police, cracking skulls of protesters. Meanwhile, 7.5 minutes ago, this motherfucker was a free speech on college campus guy.
Yeah, well, Greg Abbott literally passed a law to protect free speech on college campus when he was worried about, like, you know, Ben Shapiro or whoever not being allowed to speak. But he's the first to send in the cops. Well, he wasn't the first, but one of them to send in the cops. And he didn't even, in his tweet explaining why they're sending in the cops, he didn't even claim there was violence.
No. He said these protesters are criminals.
Anti-Semitic rhetoric, and we're not going to allow it. It's like, again, okay, even if you think that's true, which is a lie, even if you think it's true, it's still protected.
That's right. That's
like,
literally,
I don't want to hear. Someone was pointing out on Twitter too. Ryan pointed this out on Twitter. This is just down the road from Barry Weiss's little free speech.
Oh, yeah. The free speech
free
university.
Free speech university.
All of a sudden, crack the protesters' skulls. Fucking frauds. Every last one of them. Ben Shapiro, by the way, Dave Rubin. Where the fuck are you?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you? Riding in with your cape on that says free speech on the back. Oh, I'm defending Western values and the Enlightenment and Western civilization. Here I am. I'm
such
all about
frauds.
Free speech. Not that speech. Not that speech.
Such
by the
frauds.
Way, how many laws are there on the books at the state level which say you can't criticize Israel?
That's right.
Remember, in order to get hurricane relief money in Houston, Texas, you had to sign a form saying, I will not boycott Israel. How many speakers were kicked off of college campuses
mm-hmm.
like Abby Martin
That's
or
right.
Rania Kolik because they were like, I'm going to criticize Israel. I want to protest Israel. You're not allowed to do that. So you're allowed to boycott and protest the United States of America in the United States of America, but you can't criticize Israel.
Well,
and then Yahoo releases this fucking video.
That's why we always knew that the right was full of shit on free speech.
Of course.
Because they never, I mean, even before October 7th, we obviously had had instances of pro-Palestinian voices getting canceled, getting fired. It's Mark Lamont Hill. We've hosted some of them on this show. And never a word about that. Barry Weiss, when she was in college, used to be in the, you know, let's cancel the Palestinian or, you know, Palestinian sympathetic professors herself. And she claimed, oh, I changed. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. Well, no, you didn't.
Not
no, you didn't.
Not
Here you are. To your point about the echoes of history and how it's very easy 50 years later to be like, oh, yeah, those Vietnam War pros, they were right and we were wrong what we did then. Oh, well, we learned our lesson. Moving on. Did you see this? Columbia University was one of the sites of some of those protests, you know, taking over university buildings, et cetera. They have a piece on their website that actually, you know, explains how wrong they were in their response. I want to read you some of this. It's incredible. They say, Columbia is a far different place today than it was in the spring of 1968 when protesters took over university buildings amid discontent about the Vietnam War. After a week-long standoff, New York City police stormed the campus and arrested more than 700 people. The fallout dogged Columbia for years. It took decades for the university to recover from those turbulent times. And they go on to say, Columbia is commemorating the 50th anniversary of those long ago events with a deep dive of scholarship and exhibits chronicling what happened then and its effects today. They never. And here's the thing that drives me crazy is actually, well, many of the people who are cheerleading this crackdown and who are cheerleading Israel's genocide in Gaza are the same fucking people who cheerleaded for the Iraq War. And somehow not only they survived that, but they were promoted and have become even more prominent since that moment. That's number one. Some of the people were literally, you know, on the side of cracking the skulls in the Vietnam War protests. And they are on the wrong side of history every time. And the lesson is never, ever learn. It's very easy to look back a decade from now and say, and many of these people, by the way, will just pretend like they were right all along and they were on the right side of history all along. Others will make up all kinds of excuses, just like they did with the Iraq War about, oh, well, it was really understandable at the time. The intelligence was so compelling. Like, who was to know? We were so trusting of our leaders. And so it was very understandable that we were so wrong. I am never going to forget these motherfuckers. I will never forget the people who ran cover for this genocide, who justify it, who voted to send the dollars, to ship more bombs, to murder babies, to drop on refugee camps, to drop on Rafah, which invasion of which is now imminent. I will never forget these people. I am under no illusion that any of them will face any accountability. They'll just get promoted. They'll just continue to become more prominent, more successful, because that's the way the world works.
in conclusion, let's reiterate what these protesters want, not just at Columbia, not just at NYU, but broadly speaking with the multiple campuses where this stuff is going on. Number one, to the extent that certain colleges and universities have financial relations with Israel, divest those financial relations. That's thing number one. Thing number two, stop the genocide. And that means Israel, stop doing the genocide, but also U.S., stop arming and funding the genocide. That, when it gets down to the bare facts, that is what these protesters want, period. You could do whatever sort of Weasley fucking bullshit you want about, hey, I found this video that wasn't at the campus and didn't involve a student and is from a street corner with a psychopath who's screaming about how the Jews did 9/11 or whatever. People are trying to bring that up to obfuscate and make it look like this is what these protesters are bringing about. This is what they actually stand for. Mm-hmm. They're like Dana Bash said this. It's just anti-Semitism. There are literally hundreds or thousands of students doing what they're doing just because they have such a burning, passionate hatred for Jews.
Even this though many of them are themselves Jews.
This is the argument that these people are making. And what did we just watch? We just watched a foreign head of state do a video smugly lecturing all of us and the government, basically telling them, fuck your First Amendment, fuck your free speech, fuck your free protest. And by the way, those people are Nazis because they're criticizing me and they don't want me to carpet bomb babies anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. Fucking sick of it. Fucking sick of it. I've never felt even this is even worse than during the height of the Iraq war when we all felt gaslit.
Yeah.
I feel more gaslit right now.
I do, too.
I feel more. You're making me feel like I'm fucking crazy. But this shit is fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Biden's crazy, Netanyahu's crazy, and ongoing fucking genocide and ethnic cleansing is crazy.
Happening
and then some brave students stand up. Brave students stand up to say, hey, stop this. And you throw every fucking name in the book at them. And you smear them viciously. And then you wonder, why are they covering their faces? Well, gee, I wonder. Maybe because they're standing up and speaking out against the genocide, and that might lead them to never be able to get a fucking job because you people are psychos.
I mean, you literally have Bill Ackman and other billionaires organizing to make sure that anyone is involved is doxed and never employed again. So, yeah, they're going to wear masks because some of them can't handle that consequence for the rest of their life. And they shouldn't have to, by the way. You know, the last thing I'll say about this is that the reason this crackdown is happening now, which includes the TikTok ban, right? Where they didn't like that there was pro-Palestinian sentiment on TikTok, so we're just going to fucking ban it. And by the way, some of the lawmakers admit that that is the entire motivation for that bill. And the police authoritarian crackdown happening right now on college campuses is because they lost the argument. They lost the argument.
That's exactly fucking right.
Biden tried to do his little messaging. Let me first try to like leak a little bit. I'm upset. I promise you, behind the scenes, these tough conversations. All right, that didn't work. Then he was like, all right, what can I do? All right, let me do this. I'm going to build this pier. I really care. You know, announces this in the state. I really care about these Palestinian civilians. It's really, really important. I'm going to build this pier. By the way, they haven't even fucking started on the pier. It was 48 days ago that was announced. It was supposed to be done in 60 days. They still haven't even started on the pier. Okay, well, no one bought this bullshit either. All right, the little minimal things they did, the little sanctions of four settlers that they then basically rolled back. Nobody was fooled by this. And so they're not going to change the policy. So it's like, all right, well, what's the next step in the playbook?
Beat their ass. Make them fall in line.
All we can do is smear them, try to undermine them, and beat the crap out of them. Arrest them. Crush them. That's it. That's the next play. And that's where we are. So not a surprise that it happens now. I just saw another poll that came out this morning. Overwhelming majority of Americans say they don't support what Israel is doing in Gaza. This comes as we just all of our lawmakers almost, you know, very large bipartisan support for shipping more billions to Israel so they can drop more bombs on top of kids' heads. There's just no words for it.
And what are we not talking about? Because everybody's talking about the protest now.
Rafah, Gaza, kids being murdered on a playground.
The mass grave that was just uncovered, which had over 300 bodies in it. We're not talking about that. We're not talking about the inevitable invasion of Rafah.
Mm-hmm.
This is what's not being discussed.
That's
because
right.
Everybody's feelings are hurt over college kids being correct. Arrest Netanyahu. He's a fucking war criminal. Arrest Ben-Gvir. Arrest Smotrich.
Amen.
Arrest all these fucking people.
Amen.
Unless you want nonsense like this to continue. All right. So let's move on here to some Trump stuff. So we have some hearings in the Supreme Court vis-a-vis whether or not Trump can invoke a complete and total immunity argument to get out of any accountability. I just find it hilarious. The fact that he even got to this point is like, what fucking timeline do we live in? The argument got this far. You're at the Supreme Court discussing this? Like, this should have been dismissed by the fucking local dog catcher. This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life.
I mean, this is like, you know, his famous comment, you could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue.
And get away with it? Yeah,
this is like, not only will my supporters stay with me, but it's actually perfectly fine for me to do that. That's the crux of this argument. It's like, no, actually, I can shoot someone on Fifth Avenue. And as long as it was like while I was president, then it's all fine. All good.
So we have some video here, Sotomayor questioning one of the Trump attorneys. And this, I think, gives you a little insight into how this is viewed by liberals, leftists, also independents throughout the country. Take a look.
Malum in se is a concept long viewed as appropriate in law, that there's some things that are so fundamentally evil that they have to be protected against. Now, I think, your answer below, I'm going to give you a chance to say if you stay by it, if the president decides that his rival is a corrupt person and he orders the military or orders someone to assassinate him, is that within his official acts that for which he can get immunity?
It would depend on the hypothetical, but we can see that could well be an official act.
It could. And why? Because he's doing it for personal reasons. He's not doing it at, like President Obama is alleged to have done it, to protect the country from a terrorist. He's doing it for personal gain. And isn't that the nature of the allegations here, that he's not doing these acts in furtherance of an official responsibility? He's doing it for personal gain.
I agree with that characterization of the indictment, and that confirms immunity, because the characterization is that there's a series of official acts that were done for an unlawful
purpose. No, because immunity says even if you did it for personal gain, we won't hold you responsible. How could that be?
Yeah, so she's clearly not buying it. What's the argument against it? Even if you, let's grant it to Trump for argument's sake for a split second. By this logic, Biden could say, okay, and just have Trump arrested, keep him locked up indefinitely, mm-hmm. and say, I have total immunity. I get to do what I want. This is for national security. Try to steal the last election. He's hinting he's going to try to steal the next election. I am protecting our democracy by locking up this guy. And he would get away with it.
Or assassinating him is what this is being asked about here.
Right. But like, okay, even if you accept Trump's logic, then that's the place where you end up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what are we doing here? What game are we playing here? Basically, the question is, is the U.S. president an emperor? That's
right.
The question.
Right.
Are they an overlord dictator?
And what's your sense of how the arguments went? Like, who seemed to be open to that possibility?
So this is all from the recount, and this is all like just rolling in now. But let me give you from Gorsuch here. SCOTUS Justice Gorsuch presses Trump attorney John D. Johnson. Attorney D. John Sauer. That's a weird name. I tried to say John D. John Sauer. D. John Sauer on whether more in-depth adjudication of the distinction between official and private actions by a president are necessary. Gorsuch said, quote, you would agree further proceedings would be required. Sauer, quote, that is correct. So I don't know where that makes Gorsuch fall on it.
Yeah.
Then we have Amy Coney Island Barrett. Trump attorney D. John Sauer at SCOTUS immunity hearing concedes to Justice Amy Coney Barrett that several aspects of Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 election loss were private acts, not official.
Mm.
Trump has claims his efforts were official parts of
the
president.
So it sounds like potentially some of the conservative justices are skeptical.
It certainly looks like Coney Island is skeptical.
So just to give people a little bit of background on this case, you might remember there was a similar discussion that we talked about at the time, too, when it was at the D.C. Circuit Court. And where they were saying, like, wait a second, does that mean you can just, like, assassinate someone and claim, you know, assassinate Joe Biden or whoever, claim it's an official act and you're good to go as long as there isn't an impeachment and a conviction? And they were like, yeah, pretty much. And that court overwhelmingly rejected that argument. They wrote an opinion that was very strongly worded. And so there was a lot of, I guess, hope. I don't know if it was really analysis, but that because it was so overwhelming and because the opinion was so strongly worded, the Supreme Court may just decide, we're not going to take this up. They did decide to take it up. The analysis I saw at the time was that people didn't really think that the Supreme Court would uphold Trump's immunity claims, but the very fact they decided to take it up was a real victory for him because it meant that then there was going to be a delay, then it goes to oral arguments, then we have to wait for the decision to come out. And so in the meantime, all these January 6th related cases
are
on hold.
That's right.
And that's his whole goal is delay, delay, delay. And so even if the conservative justices ultimately are like, nah, this is too far even for us, which I think they may do. I don't know, but I think they may do. He has already scored a win just by having it get to the Supreme Court and have to go through this process and wait the, you know, whatever the normal period is to get this decision.
And by the way, this doesn't apply to the hush money case that's going on in New York right now because
right.
the hush money case took place or the action took place before he was president.
Yeah.
And so nobody can argue presidential immunity before you're president.
It's interesting how, I mean, it's funny how that one, ironically, has ended up.
Everybody's last hope here.
It's, I'm sort of a dissenter from the people who say that there's like, in terms of political impact, that like, oh, it's just baked in, like, it's just Trump being Trump.
I think it's the weakest of the cases, I do.
I mean, I think it is the weakest of the cases. But the other thing about it is the details, people want to know these details. Like, they want to, it's a lot less boring.
Yeah.
Just on like a human level, you got mm-hmm. a tabloid publisher. I mean, David Pecker's testimony was fascinating. I was interested in it, you know, like how the catch and kill works and this relationship he had with Trump, like that he was planting, making up literally these stories about Ted Cruz and
fake news factory,
Marco Rubio's love child stunner and all this stuff. Like
all fake.
Yeah, these are really interesting, tawdry details. And I'm sure whatever Stormy Daniels has to say is going to be interesting. And
she says he has a little mushroom.
whatever. Like,
she says, you know, Toad, the character in Mario?
Yes, I remember
He's got a little mushroom dick.
I'd rather not talk about that.
I'm just saying he's got a little tiny little mushroom peepee. That's the word on the street.
But in terms of like human being, look, Trump would understand that sex sells. These sorts of like tawdry celebrity reality TV show dramas are really captivating to the American public. So I think the details are going to be something that people pay attention to. I think they're also, you know, they're from a sort of moral ethical angle, they're really indefensible. You know, you're trying to hide this affair from your wife and the American public. So I don't fully buy the argument that like, people just like, this is Trump and it's not going to have any impact on him politically.
Counterpoint.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton's approval rating went up when all the stuff was going on about Monica blowing him and there was the Star report. So people were like, yeah, you shouldn't have done that. Yeah, he's kind of pervy. But also, what the fuck are we wasting time for on this? There's more important things. Stop it.
Yeah, that's fair. But there was no like direct, you know, he's making these payments and trying to hide it from the public in the context of an election either.
So it hinges on, are people going to care enough about that thing?
Look, yeah.
I'm on the side of, I think this is the weakest case, but that doesn't mean, like the Trump people say, it's going to benefit him. I actually don't think it's going to benefit him. And it's honestly not just because of this case, because of all the news recently. I mean, we just heard $454 million fine because of tax fraud, insurance fraud, business fraud, 78 different kinds of fraud. He has to pay E. Jean Carroll, whatever it was, $100 million or something like that because of the defamation, which was linked to some sexual assault stuff. When you get hit one after the other, after the other, after the other, after the other, everybody's like, okay, where there's smoke, there's fire. Or let me rephrase that. Every reasonable person is like, yeah, where there's smoke, there's fire. Sure, the Trump cult people, whenever there's a new indictment or new charge, his numbers go up. But that's only amongst that 30% of the population.
Right.
Right? Amongst Democrats, independents, moderates, some moderate Republicans, those people are like, this is the best we can do? Fucking really? This is the best we can do? This guy here? So I think it's the weakest case, but that doesn't mean that this is like a benefit for him or anything like that. Like a lot of goofballs are arguing right now, like Sean Hannity.
Yeah, definitely not that.
Yeah.
Definitely not that. All right, should we get to our guest?
Let's do it.
All right, so we're lucky to be joined by comedian Dave Smith. He's also host of Part of the Problem podcast. Talk to him about a range of things. Let's go ahead and get to it.
All right. Thanks for joining us. Dave Smith, libertarian, host of Part of the Problem podcast. And of course, he was involved in a mega debate the other day with both Cenk Uygur as his partner, which, by the way, I could talk a lot about just that. I like seeing a libertarian and a lefty sort of work together on something that was healing for the soul. Mm-hmm. But you were up against Dennis Prager and Batya Unger Sargon. So let me start with, is Dennis Prager a prick behind the scenes? Because that is like, that's the vibe I got. And I have some sources who shall not be named, who were in the vicinity and said, yeah, he's a fucking asshole in real life. Was that your experience, or was he actually a nice guy?
Okay, so I had the same vibe, and I was like, when the debate was over, I was like, oh, this guy's not going to look me in the eye or shake my hand or anything like that. But he wasn't. He wasn't like that. We all went out to dinner afterward. Everyone except Sagar. He's too good for us, apparently.
Sagar, no, listen, in his defense, Sagar legitimately goes to bed at like 8 p.m. every night.
He's on the Huberman train.
yeah, that's true. That's actually true. That's what that's about.
I have no sympathy for this defense. I have two little kids. I'm always exhausted. There's never a moment. Right now, I could close my eyes and just go to sleep. So no excuse. But Dennis didn't stay that long. He came for a little bit, but like he was nice. But I don't know, you know, if you've heard from other people that he's a prick, that might be true. I didn't like get to know the guy well enough. I kind of felt like, I mean, maybe it's a little messed up for me to say this, but I just thought the results of the debate were so thoroughly one-sided.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that like I did such a great job. It was more just
you did,
that.
Though.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But it was more like that he just didn't do anything. I felt like I used the example. I was like, if you were like a boxer and you showed up to a big prize fight and then the guy just put his hands down. And just,
well, the moment,
like, didn't throw any punches.
There were a lot of moments that stick with me, but one in particular is when he's like, name an atrocity that Israel has committed.
You're like, we cover that.
What? Like, I could name them that happened literally yesterday, right? We could spend all day here talking about what's been done since October 7th. It was so astonishing to me, and I would love to get your reaction to, like, what you were thinking in that moment, because it just makes me ask the question, is he so much in the bubble that he actually believes that? Or is he just lying? Is he just, you know, a spin master and a propagandist and thinks he can get one over on us? Because anyone who's actually following what's happening and watching what's happening in the Gaza Strip cannot say that with a straight face.
Yeah, like, right. So whatever side you're on, even if you're like on the pro-Israeli side, it's really, those are the only options. What you said, like, either you don't know anything about this, or you're just lying. And, you know, like, even if you, like, someone like, say, Benny Morris, who somehow twists himself into pretzels to defend this, would never sit there and be like, Deir Yassin, that was it. That was the only atrocity. Yeah. Name one other one. Like, no one would say that. That moment actually, like, messed with me a little bit, because there's these weird things when you're in a debate, there's all these kind of, like, tactics and framing. And so I was making the point about Benjamin Netanyahu propping up Hamas. And how that undercuts the Israeli excuse for this war. And then he just mentioned the massacre in the Olympics in Germany. And so then I just mentioned Deir Yassin is like, okay, we could all mention atrocities, you know, like that has nothing to do with my point. And then he's like, name one more than that. And I was kind of baffled for a moment. Like, in that moment, it was good that I had Cenk there with me, because he came in and kind of caught my back. But I was just so blown away that, like, I was like, well, do I try to get back to the point I was making? Do you actually think I can't name another atrocity? Then, like, in your head, like, all the atrocities are going off. I'm like, wait, should I get into, like, Lebanon in the 80s and the assassination campaigns? And,
like, I actually thought about that, too, because I was like, even Ronald Reagan called that a Holocaust.
Yes, right. Like, it's just, it's nobody who's being honest on any side of this issue would ever pretend you couldn't come up with another one. And then also in my mind, it's like he downplayed Deir Yassin by saying,
yeah, he said it doesn't count. That's
well, it was during a war. Like, it was one time during a war. And then I kind of was like, almost in my mind, like, well, no, let's really get into what happened there, because, like, that's so not an excuse. Like, it was in a war. I mean, kind of, they call that period a civil war. This is in early 1948, before any of the other Arab nations had intervened. And yes, there were street clashes. By the way, on the Palestinian side, with a mostly disarmed, from the British having disarmed them after the Arab revolts, from a mostly disarmed group of peasants shooting at them with old rifles on the streets. And so then these militias, the Ergon and the Stern Gang, decide to march into a village and rape all of the women and murder all of the children and murder all of the men. Like, I'm sorry, that's not, no, you weren't like at war with that village. So anyway, I don't know. But to me, the moment in the debate, honestly, was when his opening, because I kind of went in there with like a thing of, you know, look, I'm a comedian who, I mean, I'm obsessed with this stuff. I'm a comedian who likes to read books. And Dennis Prager has been doing talk radio since before I was born, or mm-hmm. right around since I've been born. And this is like his issue. So I'm going in to debate a guy who on his issue, and he's been on TV and radio since before I was born. And I was like, you know, all right, I better really be on point and do a good job here. And in his opening statement, he opened with his tagline of like, one side wants peace and the other side wants them dead.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. in that moment, I was just like, oh, he's got nothing. I mean,
that's right.
He just has every nothing. Talking point that you've heard a million times before.
But it would be like if I opened and my opening statement was, there are no Arabs who embrace terrorism.
Right.
That's not true. Mm-hmm. You know, and you'd be like, well, that's ridiculous. This you can't
total
say
total denial
that.
Of reality.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's interesting because as you're pointing out, it's kind of an effective tactic. Like if you're just thinking tact, because it was like
narrativizing as
well. Yeah, well, it's so then you have to spend time like grappling with reality, you know, in a way that then you can't get to these other points that you want to make. But, you know, what was astonishing to me is he opens with that. Oh, who wants peace? And be honest with yourself. You know, if the Palestinians laid down their weapons, there'd be peace. If the Israelis laid down their weapons, then they'd all be murdered. And like, you have to admit that that's the case. And then later on in the debate, he admits like, no, I don't want a two-state solution.
Yeah.
So
they don't want peace, by the way. I don't want peace, but
they don't want peace. They're the problem. But I, you know, I also don't accept peace.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good point. I also just think these hypotheticals are stupid. I mean, it would be like as if, you know, in 2002, when the war drums were beating to invade Iraq, and someone were to say, well, like, ask me this question. What would be worse if Saddam Hussein was president of the United States of America or if George Bush was the president of Iraq?
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, but that's not the situation at all. So like, what are you proving? And by the way, in that example, yes, it would be worse if Saddam Hussein was the president of the United States of America. And it would be better if George W. Bush was the president in Iraq. But like, what does that mean? That's none of that is even plausibly going to be the reality of the situation. And so how about we look at what's actually happening, which is that George W. Bush is lying through his teeth to try to drum up interest in a war. And so like, I don't know, I just, all of that is stupid. It's just, it's nothing. It doesn't, it's completely irrelevant.
His reaction to you was to say, scream at the top of his lungs, you libeled.
Oh,
so from our perspective, we looked at that as he wanted to say that's blood libel. He wanted to say that, but he reeled it in a little bit and just went with libel. Is that how you interpreted it in the moment? And then a point Crystal and I made in the aftermath, I didn't know this at the time. I had to look it up. I was like, wasn't Dave Smith raised Jewish? And so effectively he's trying to call you raised Jewish and anti-Semite in that moment because he was saying name an atrocity. And in your mind, you're like, there's 842 of them. I'm not just going to spit one out, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I you know, it's they're just kind of reduced to these like slogans and talking points and accusations. And I just think anyone with a mind can see that that's not like you can't win a debate by just screaming libel at someone. And of course, you know, like, I'm Jewish. And there's Rabbi Barclay called me on a Candace Owens show. He called me a self-hating Jew. You know, that's mm-hmm. just like kind of the thing that you get called. It's so like, what does that even mean? Do you think I hate myself? Like, I'm so clearly awesome. Why would I hate myself? And like I hate my grandma or something like that, because I think what Israel's doing to the Palestinians is wrong. But honestly, like the war propagandists always rely on stuff that's this stupid. Again, it was the you're either with the troops or you're with the terrorists, right? This was always the line of the George W. Bush administration. Either
they hate us because we're free.
Right. It's just the dumbest things that anyone with a mind should be able to see through.
Do you think he was trying to say blood libel, though? Do you think that there was an implication there of like anti-Semite, or do you think that it was more neutral than that? And he was just trying to say, you're lying, not you're lying and you hate Jews.
Well, I mean, it is the same word that they always use in that term. So maybe, right. I mean, I can't read his
and
mind.
No one uses it in any other context.
Yeah, right. I've never heard
like,
that.
Is that even proper English to say you libeled?
No, yeah, it does. Like, you committed libel, something like
that.
It
sounds right? clunky for sure. Yeah. You know, it's also, you know, he was really emotional in the debate. Yeah. Like, I could see his eyes were like welding up and stuff. And so I think there's got to be something, you know, I don't know exactly, but there's got to be something to having this issue that is your main issue for your entire life that defines who you are. And then you have nothing, you have no arguments to back it up, and you're getting very emotional about it. And really the tactic that they have is like, you're a bad person in one way or another to say that, like, you're a bad person. And, you know, I don't know. I know who I am as a person, and I also know what's going on, and I know what the history of this is. And it's just like, nope, sorry. This doesn't make me a bad person. I got lots of qualities that I could work on that aren't so great, but this here doesn't make me a bad person. Like, so. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that's actually a good transition to some of what we see going on right now, because in a sense, like, what happens to you or me or Kyle on a micro level, where it's like, when people feel they've lost the debate, it's like, you're actually just an anti-Semite. That's why you have these opinions. That's all there is to it. I mean, that's what you see with the, you know, the now authoritarian crackdown that's happening in New York, in LA, in Texas, against these campus protesters, where they'll take, you know, one incident that is genuinely anti-Semitic or genuinely, you know, problematic in one way or another, and use that to smear an entire multi-faith, including many Jewish students, movement as, oh, you just hate Jews. According to Benjamin Netanyahu, you're just basically Nazis and you just want to kill all Jews wherever they are. That's literally what he said, to try to delegitimize the entire point that they're attempting to make.
Yeah, I think that's definitely happening. And, you know, I've been critical of certain aspects of the protests. And I still am, although I will say after this last week, I'm less inclined to be, because it's I just hate how the entire corporate media is trying to make this the story, as if like the real story is what Israel is doing to Gaza right now. I'm sorry, this is all secondary to that. But look, I could be critical of some of the things that have happened at these some of these protests. But the truth is, if we're going to talk about it, look, in so just to be clear on what's going on here, like in 2020 in the summer, you had the George Floyd protests that were almost nightly devolving into looting and property damage to the tunes of billions of dollars nationwide. There were hundreds and hundreds of assaults. There were dozens of murders. Nothing like that is happening here. That's just, it's just not anything comparable to that. And even as somebody who has been a long critic of the police in this country, in the summer of 2020, I was like, all of you guys should stop protesting, because this is just, you're almost kind of giving cover to this. Now, of course, the police response to that was to like tear gas peaceful protesters and then stand down when the rioters came. So it was just insane. But,
right, true.
But, you know, in this case, it's nothing like that. I mean, really, aside from some isolated incidents where there has been some violence, and like, I'm sure we all agree, like, those cases should be prosecuted. But really, the discussion here, for the most part, has been over what they're hollering at these protests.
Right.
You know, like, and how that makes people feel. And I think, and I don't know, me and you guys might disagree about some of this, although I don't know if we will. But I think that over, say, like the last decade, the rise of like wokeness, or whatever you want to call it, on the left, this kind of, and I'm speaking broadly, like there's obviously exceptions to this, but this kind of obsessive hyper focus on race and gender and sexual preference, and the kind of intense focus on very minor infractions, it like almost an inability to distinguish between what really matters and what doesn't really matter, and that you're never allowed to say, like, yeah, that just doesn't matter. I don't know. a foreign student was asked, where are you from? That's a microaggression. And nobody can just go, I don't care. That's just not that important. There's way bigger things going on here.
Like, it's that whole like words are literal violence.
Yes.
And it's like, no, they're actually not.
And so now that's being weaponized by the people claiming that like Jewish students are made to feel unsafe, as if that's supposed to garner more sympathy for me than what's happening to the Palestinian people is just like, I don't even know how to even wrap my head around making this claim. But I will say that they're also look like there's okay. So I just saw today they had a Seder in one of the protests at Columbia. And it's like, yes, perfect. That's what you do. Like, that's how to effectively engage in this, you know, political process, which is what protesting is. It's a strategic political activity. And like, that's what you do. You shatter their narrative. Here we are in the middle with a bunch of Jewish students and a bunch of, you know, Muslim students all sitting around doing like a Jewish ritual. Like, okay. But then there have been other incidents here. And again, I want to make it clear, like, because I'm trying to prioritize these things. I'm just talking about what they're hollering. There have been lots of protests where they're hollering things like death to America, or they're saying like the one in Georgetown where they were chanting something like, we have hang gliders, glory to the freedom fighters. And you're just like, guys, this is just, first of all, it's awful. But second of all, it's so counterproductive. Like, what are you doing? Like, are you Mossad agents? Which, you know, I'm not ruling out the possibility, but you know, possible. But if you're not, you know, you couldn't be doing a better job if you were. So that, you know, I do think it's reasonable to be critical of some of that stuff.
Yeah. So first of all, a lot of great stuff to respond to there. Let's jump into it. So first of all, the idea that now you have basically the establishment and corporate media using the same tools that were in the woke toolbox. I completely agree. That's a perfect description of what's going on here. In terms of like the protests, I'm interested in your thoughts because I talked about this on my show that I think there's like a rigid hierarchy of how to protest, what's most effective, what's most intelligent. And right at the top, I would put things like what we saw in like the late October, early November, where people were trying to block ships that had weapons on it that were bound for Israel. And that might be like they might literally be committing a crime there. Like they could probably spend time behind bars for that one. But in terms of like, this is effective. This makes sense. We know those weapons are being used to carpet bomb babies.
Yep.
That's top of the list for me. Right underneath that, or maybe like 1A and 1B, I would put yelling it at the politicians who are making the decisions to keep sending money and weapons to Israel and keep voting for all these wars. Those I think would be the best. And I think you and I would probably agree that at the very bottom is something like blocking roads for regular people or blocking the Golden Gate Bridge or blocking people from getting to O'Hare Airport, as we saw recently. But I have to admit, David, I'm curious what your thoughts are on this. I am kind of conflicted on even doing that, right? Because on the one hand, it's like these people have nothing to do with the genocide. They didn't do anything wrong. Like, why are you victimizing them? They're not part of the problem. You're just making people hate you. I think all that is true. But at the same time, I also think it's true that if there was enough of shit like that being done, then eventually it does get to the president's ear where they're like, motherfucker, you got to do something to change this because every single bridge is blocked in America. Every single airport is blocked. And all they're saying is stop sending weapons to Israel. If you stop doing that, they will stop protesting. So I'm curious what you think. Are you as torn on those as me, or are you on the side of like, nah, just don't fucking do that at all?
No, I'm on the don't do that at all side. And, you know, even in your scenario where you go, if every bridge and every airport in the country is blocked, I think you're much more likely to see the effect of the American people completely turning against the pro-Palestinian cause rather than seeing this like result in ending the support for the war. I mean, look, I look at it kind of in the same way that I do. The way I look at war in general, where it's like, you don't have a right to do this to innocent people. And, you know, when you're blocking roads, this is not just like potentially inconveniencing somebody. Like there's ambulances that might be on that road. Somebody's baby might be in that ambulance. Like, no, you don't have a right to do that. So I'm with you. Take it to the people who it actually affects. Like, what is this? Running in a Starbucks and like screaming through a bullhorn at people, I think is just totally stupid. Not on the level of blocking roads or something like that. But you know, like there's an Israeli embassy in this country and there's a Capitol Hill and there's all these places you could go and like actually inconvenience those people. And that I do not care about at all. And in fact, I support doing that. So that's kind of my take.
Yeah. The other thing for me is I just, I feel like people are so horrified by what they see that there's just a sense of desperation of like, we got to try whatever we can fucking try. Like whatever we can figure out to try to throw against the wall. Like we've got to try to stop, you know, a genocide that's unfolding. And I especially gain more sympathy for them when I see like the Jonathan Chaits of the world. Did you read his piece accusing?
This was
before the campus crackdown or whatever. He accused people who went and disrupted Joe Biden's speeches as being authoritarian and illiberal. And it's like,
that's stupid.
It's so stupid.
So bad. You got to read it.
Attempted to make a free speech argument about how you were blocking the speech of Joe Biden, which number one, the man has $1 billion in the bank to spend on his speech. Number two, he has the bully pulpit. Number three, he apparently has no interest in speaking to the American people, judging by the fact that he does like literally no interviews. It was just the most like gaslighting thing I've ever seen.
Well, you know what happens? And look, I haven't read the piece, but I feel like what happens in a lot of these cases, I've seen this a lot, is that when somebody has a pet issue, again, like I was saying, like Dennis Prager, it starts to almost like define their identity. Mm-hmm. And then they try to kind of force every other issue into that field. So I think if you've spent a lot of time talking about how, like, say, disrupting a speech on a college campus isn't your free speech right, you're actually kind of cracking down on somebody else's free speech. And, you know, however you may feel about him, over the years, we've seen these things where like Jordan Peterson will go to give a lecture or something. And there are, you know, protesters just trying to drown him out, much like the debate tactic that you dealt with on Piers Morgan the other day. And, you know, you'd kind of rightfully be criticizing these kids. Like, what's wrong with you? Like the spirit of a liberal arts college should be that you hear out what he has to say and then ask tough questions when there's a question and answer segment or something. But I almost feel like he's trying to apply that to this, which is totally different. You know, like this is not, that's not true at all. Like Joe Biden is the supposed servant of the public. This is not a situation where, you know, it's anything analogous to that. So that would kind of be my guess. I see this happen a lot in general, where people, if they have one area that they specialize in, they try to reduce everything else to that. It's part of the reason why all of the new atheists became neocons, because their pet issue is that religion's bad. And so that's how they see this conflict. Well, who's the most religious? Now, the most religious fundamentalists are over there on the Muslim side, so then we better be on this more secular side. However, you know, obviously, you could recognize the problems with fundamentalist religious ideologies, but also recognize that the far greater evil here is like slaughtering innocent people by the hundreds of thousands. So if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So to go back to the slogans, because I actually think there's a really interesting conversation to have about this in particular. I agree with your point on well, first, let me say this. I think it is largely overstated in the media just how much like negative chanting there is out there. I think in the overwhelming majority of instances, if anything, you're more likely to see the cringe woke shit where they're like doing a land acknowledgement before they give a speech, or they're doing some weird dance in a certain, like, I think that's more likely than like the genuinely horrific slogans. But to your point, when I do see something along those lines, whether it's some sort of support to October 7th or Death to America, like you pointed out.
The Burn Tel Aviv one. The Burn Tel Aviv one.
But on that one, I was skeptical. It was real. I'm not. So anyway, I'll digress for just a second. I'll point out, I'm a little skeptical as to, I think some of these things are real, but I think some of them might not be. Like we just saw Gavin McGinnis was at one of these protests. Somebody recorded him and it's like, well, if you got Proud Boys out there and their whole thing is like fucking up left-wing protesters, how do we know that there's not some agent provocateurs from him or from Mossad? Or this is all conspiratorial. This is all speculation. I'll admit that up front. But I agree with you on the Death to America one. I agree with you on the October 7th stuff. But there's other ones where I think the media is being incredibly dense to the context in this situation. So, for example, the two big ones, of course, would be From the River to the Sea and Intifada. Now, I grant that when you hear a Hamas spokesperson say on an Iranian news show, From the River to the Sea, Palestine will be free. And then he goes on to say, we're going to do October 7th over and over and over and over. I grant that in that instance, that's a condemnable phrase. And he means it like, let's drive all the Jews into the sea. I agree with that. But I think when you have some pink-haired college student who's 20 years old and lives in Burbank, and they're chanting From the River to the Sea, Palestine will be free, I think they genuinely mean it as more of a liberation call where you'll have a one-state democratic solution for all, and everybody has rights. And even on the Intifada front, you know, my belief on the Intifada front is it does mean uprising. Is it true that historically there have been violent intifadas? Absolutely, that's true. And everybody should acknowledge that. But at the same time, people could definitely mean intifada in the context of 2018 Great March of Return type stuff. Or they could mean it in the context of Palestinians have a legitimate right to defend themselves against military targets, right? So do you agree with me that the context for intifada and From the River to the Sea in particular are sort of, it's nuanced and it varies what people means when they say it. So we should hold off on like the broad condemnation.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that's right. I think like From the River to the Sea could mean different things. And I'm sure in people's minds it does. To be perfectly honest, I don't really know what is in that pink hair 20-year-old college kid's mind when they're saying it. And I'm kind of interested, but I don't exactly know what it is. You know, the way I see it is that there's this kind of interesting dynamic where the way I look at it is like the left was so on point during the George W. Bush years. And I was an anti-war lefty during those years. And it was all like this kind, this is, it really was before this woke stuff like swept everything. And the protesters there would always be making the argument that the Patriot Act is un-American. And that, like, it wasn't a death to America type vibe. It was like a, no, you're the deviationist here. Like, we're representing the true American spirit. And the left, again, I'm speaking broadly here. I think you two are like exceptions to this, but the left, mm-hmm. broadly speaking, was just so destroyed during the Barack Obama years when he continued and escalated the George W. Bush foreign policy. And it was just like too much cognitive dissonance or something. And they couldn't criticize him for that. And then you had the rise of this hyper-focus on identitarianism and racialism and gender and all this stuff. And like I was talking about before, like the inability to distinguish between priorities. This is why in the middle of Black Lives Matter, you'd see these demands to get rid of Aunt Jemima, like as if that should be at the top of the priority lists here. It's like crazy, crazy stuff. And I was hopeful when Donald Trump first came in that the left was going to get better, that it was like, oh, well, now that your enemy is in charge of the war machine, maybe it'll be easier to criticize it. But unfortunately, this correction just never came. And they were so triggered by Donald Trump that they just jumped on the narrative of whoever his enemies were, in this case, the CIA. And so they were just like, oh, yeah, he's a Russian agent. And just, you know, all of this kind of delusional stuff. And I feel like, okay, so the anti-war left was just gone for the most part. And now they've come back, but they haven't like shaken off any of this insane woke ideology. They've just come back with it. And it does kind of lead to this question of like, why are you guys back? Which I don't exactly understand. Like, why are you here now? I'm glad to some degree, like, okay, good, you're against this awful thing, but where were you exactly when Obama escalated the war in Afghanistan or when he went into Libya or Syria or Somalia or Yemen? Where were you, you know, like during this whole Ukrainian conflict? And why is it that now you've popped back up to oppose Israel? And what the pro-Israeli narrative will be is
they're
that
anti-Semites.
Right. It's just because they hate Jews. Yeah. They don't care right. when anyone else does it. It's just that they hate Jews. I personally think it's much more some type of connection of like the oppressor versus the oppressed, of like they're seeing Israel as the straight white man in this scenario, and they're seeing the Palestinians as the marginalized minority. Now, in this case, I think that might lead them to the correct answer, which is that right. this war mm-hmm. is bad, but their methodology is so flawed in getting there that you still have these really fundamental philosophical problems with their worldview. That's kind of my feeling.
I think that's all fair, but at the same time, I'm one to make the argument like, don't look the gift horse in the mouth, right? Well, like, take yes for it. Like, you're a libertarian, I'm a lefty, she's a lefty, but we all agree on this issue, so we could talk about this issue and work together on this issue. And I feel like it's a similar thing with the pink-haired college kid. I agree. I wouldn't agree with the pink-haired college kid on much, and I think they'd be way too sensitive, way too authoritarian in other contexts. They would want to ban a Jordan Peterson or a Ben Shapiro from coming to speak. But if they're right on this, I'm like, fuck it, I'll take it. I'll take the yes.
So there's a few things that I want to say, because I think that's all very interesting. So first of all, I think it's important to remember that, you know, the left had the Occupy Wall Street moment that was very sort of like populist, universalist, you know, really, you know, 99% versus the 1%, good messaging, all of that. And out of that comes the Bernie Sanders movement, which especially at the beginning had that same like universalist, populist energy. And do you remember what Hillary Clinton said about how like breaking up the big banks won't solve racism, right? This direction of the quote unquote left, which was most embraced by liberals, really came from that Hillary Clinton rebuke of Bernie Sanders of like, well, sure, all this like tax the rich and Medicare, but that's all fine. But what we really need to focus on is the equivalent of the microaggressions and, you know, the virtue signaling and whatever. And there's a reason why this was so widely embraced, because that sort of a critique is not really a critique. It's very easy for a corporation to hire a DEI consultant and not have to be taxed more or do anything different or like have to deal with workers' unions or anything else, right? So this becomes widely embraced and taken up. And, you know, it's just sort of like in the air that like these young people now who are involved in these protests, I mean, they were babies when it was Barack Obama, and this is like in the air of when they're coming up. And so their interpretation of what it means to be to the left is like to do those things, but on steroids.
Yeah,
and that's kind of, you know, that's the cultural ecosystem and milieu that they're coming up in. So there's that. In terms of why the intense focus and all the energy around Israel in particular, I think it's too dismissive to say that it's, oh, they have this oppressor-oppressed dynamic and they're just applying it here. I mean, because I feel it's like, the things that I'm seeing being done there and being done with my tax dollars, like I think I said this to you before, I've never felt more libertarian about like, fuck paying taxes. Like they're going to drop bombs on babies.
Cenk said the same thing.
And some of these things, however cynical I've been in politics, it hasn't been enough. I mean, I'm a little embarrassed to say, but I never could have imagined that we would all be watching, I know you don't like the word, but a genocide unfold in front of our eyes on TikTok, a mass slaughter, a collective siege, babies starving to death where we're watching them in real time take their last breaths, and then have this monolith between the Democrats and the Republicans like, yeah, we see that too. We're going to send them more bombs so that they can keep doing the same thing. That's what we're going to do. And anyone who dissents, we're going to send in the police to crush their, you know, crush their protests. And we're here for Israel. It doesn't matter what. We don't care. That has actually been, again, I'm a little embarrassed to admit it, but it has actually been shocking to me that level of brazenness and the just level of depravity. So to me, it's not a surprise. In fact, Sagar and I debated this early on. I was like, this is going to be this generation's Iraq war moment. He was like, it's a foreign, you know, young people aren't being sent overseas like Vietnam. It's different. I was like, no, I'm telling you, because there, it's so horrifying that this is on the table. Like this is on the table. I didn't know this was even on the table. So I think there's such a revulsion to that it makes all the sense in the world to me that this has become such a central cause. And I don't know, but if I had to predict, I think there will be a little bit of a corrective now. In fact, I think there already was a bit of a corrective to some of the like craziest woke excesses, et cetera. Because now you have the example of like, oh, what we were saying about how like, yay, we're pro-censorship when it's speech we don't agree with. This is being applied now to us. And you know what? The whole free speech thing, that actually sounds pretty good. People should be allowed to say things that are controversial without having their skulls cracked.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, look, I certainly agree with you. The thing that really does, you know, separate this war is just how many of the images we all see. And I've never seen so many from any war. And even in the war in Ukraine, where there's lots of horrible things happening, I haven't seen like images of babies dying at nearly the rate of this. I did see a lot, although not nearly as much, when the U.S.-Saudi backed war in, or I should say the Saudi-U.S. backed war in Yemen, which was just the absolute worst thing in the world, every bit as bad as this, and for much, much longer. And there didn't seem to be any big outcry over it. But just to the point you were talking about initially, I've been talking about this for years now, but you have these guys like say Ben Shapiro and Jordan Peterson, and they've been making this argument for years that basically the left took over the liberals and that they're all leftists now. And
right, they're all Marxists, blah, blah, blah.
There's a certain, like there's something plausible about that, because if you listen to, like, say, the corporate media, they are promoting, like, these ideas of, like, critical race theory that were far left-wing ideas. But at the same time, that was only one little sliver of the left and, like, the intellectual tradition of left-wing thought. And they picked this one sliver, okay, and then blasted it out from all of their biggest megaphones. And you can go look at this in the in like the Nexus charts, when you see like how many times the word systemic oppression and toxic masculinity and transgenderism and how it just all shoots up like in 2012. And so basically my thesis is that this was a neoliberal takeover of the left, and it worked to stunning levels. It worked so well. And the real point there is that it's not, look, obviously Hillary Clinton wasn't interested in ending racism. She was interested in you stopping to care about what the big banks are doing. And so basically what happened is they threw all of these young lefties onto these like social, you know, like trails leading to nothingness, where now we're having a conversation about whatever, like transgender bathrooms, and however you feel about that, whatever side of that conversation you're on, the point is that nobody at the CIA or the Federal Reserve or JP Morgan Chase cares that you're having that conversation. Mm-hmm. It's also part of the reason why they, even really important issues like abortion, like that's a really important issue, but no one at the big banks is scared about you having that fight. Like, go on out and fight about that. They like that. They didn't like Occupy Wall Street. They don't like a group of people standing outside the big banks screaming, "We are the 99%. And so I think this was essentially an op that worked very well, and it was a neoliberal takeover of the left. Anyway, to your point about like, if this is our generation's Iraq, I mean, I'll say at least right now, it's hard to make these predictions. It feels like, for whatever reason, like the war in Libya, and the war in Syria and the war in Yemen and all these other horrific wars just didn't get this much attention. And for whatever reason, this one's getting it. And so I don't know if it's Iraq, but it's bigger than any of those already. So in terms of like bigger in the mind of the American people than any of those.
Yeah. So I'm going to agree and disagree with both of you in parts. So on the oppressor oppressed narrative thing, I think you're actually right that a lot of the kids who now care about this, they did come to this through that framework. I think that's correct. But I also agree with you that it's also, at least in part, waking up to the carnage of what's happening, right? So I think you're both right on that one. On the free speech thing, that like, well, now these kids will care about free speech. I actually think they'll just flip back when it comes to like an Ann Coulter or Ben Shapiro giving a speech. You know what I mean? I think they'll do the same thing that the right does now, where the right screams free speech when it's them. But when it's somebody they disagree with, all of a sudden they're like, drop the hammer and let's be authoritarian.
Counting on human hypocrisy is usually
a good bet. On the identity stuff. Yeah, I think like the reason why the identity stuff has become so pervasive is because it's the least power threatening. And that's why it's the loudest. And that's why it's the most pervasive. That's why it's comfortable for a Hillary Clinton or corporate media to sort of push that out there.
It was also very convenient for them to crush the left and be like, you're not the real progressives.
Yeah,
they got
out radical, the actual radicals, by saying, well, we want a DEI program. And it's like, fucking okay, who cares, right? And I think they're... are leftists that it's not just liberals that have the hyper identitarian problem. I do think there are some leftists, particularly young leftists, who also are like equally focused or maybe even more focused on hyper identitarianism. And I think that's a problem. But I also think it kind of gets underplayed just how many classic traditional class focused leftists are still out there. You know what I mean? Because it's easy to do a boogeyman of the left by saying they're all these hyper identity focused freaks, and we just totally disregard all the classic Marxian type leftists who are like, all I care about is fucking class, right? Viva la revolution type shit.
I wish there were more of us, frankly. I'm not sure there are that many of us, but I wish there were. But
he's not with us on that one because he's a libertarian, but that's your version of leftism. That's
but,
right.
But I like those leftists better.
Well, thank you.
You like libertarians better than a lot of people on our side, right?
Something I was curious about from you, Dave, though, is that, you know, it almost flipped whereas, you know, the liberals were using identity as an explanation for like literally everything. And then the right picks up wokeness and it's getting applied as a similarly like convenient excuse to let big banks off the hook and whatever, where it's like, oh, Silicon Valley Bank failed. We'll look at their board. They've got a gay person. So obviously it's the wokeness that was the problem here. And so I felt like the dynamic flipped where it actually became the right that was more obsessed with wokeness than even like the woke people were obsessed with wokeness. And it really fell flat. I mean, look at Ron DeSantis, who launched his whole campaign on like Florida's where wokeness comes to die or whatever. And even he started abandoning the term because it just no one cared. And again, it's like a convenient thing to lay on any problem that corporations don't care if they do have the gay guy on the board or if they don't have the gay guy on the board. So either way, if that's what you're fighting about is whether or not the one gay guy is on the board, either way, that's a win for them.
Yeah, I mean, there's actual images of floats at the gay pride parade with Bank of America logos at the bottom of it.
Absolutely.
And you're just like, doesn't that just say it all? That's it right there. Like, could you imagine from the perspective of like big banks, it, like during Occupy Wall Street, if the deal was like, all right, how about we buy you a gay float and you all go away? Like, okay, like that'd be a pretty good deal from Bank of America's point of view. And well, look, I also think what you're getting at, like the other half of this op was that, yeah, they also drew the right wingers into having the same dumb discussion. And these people like Ben Shapiro, who became famous for what? For going and arguing with some 19-year-old who's, and she's like, you know, I was born a man. Why can't I be a woman? And he's like, why can't you be a bird? And everyone's like, oh my God, the intellectual prowess of Ben Shapiro, you know, like as if like, what are you even doing with yourself? I mean, look, obviously like this college kid's an idiot, but like, what are you, some hero for like taking this down? And so it all got just, you know, like, dumbed down and drawn into these conversations that are totally unimportant. Like, just like I was saying before, like these things that it's like, you're never allowed to be like, guys, this just doesn't matter that much. Like things that matter so much more are happening. Like, how about, you know, during this period, right? From 2008 through 2020, you had the two, and this is kind of where libertarians and leftists like yourself can all come together, is that you had the two biggest transfers of wealth in human history, and they both went from the working class and middle class to the uber-rich, politically connected class. And like, you could have whatever conversation, like, I might support the free market, and you guys might support, like, redistributive policies from the rich to the poor, but like, who the hell supports redistributive policies from the poor to the rich? Mm-hmm. And like, this is all going on while our national conversation has devolved into whether Ben Shapiro owned that 19-year-old. And so It's the whole thing just, you know, and again, right, like your example with all this stuff is all good examples. But then on top of that, one of the things that have been that people have been reminded of, or maybe introduced to for the first time, I was certainly well aware of it, but all of these, the right-wingers who are the Zionist hawks, they were the originators of this woke stuff.
They were always the first wokesters.
Now you're seeing that reemerge. But this was always the thing that, oh, if you criticize Israel, you hate Jews. And isn't that the exact same argument as every woke leftist is making? If I criticize any of the things they believe in, that means I'm a racist. And it's been interesting and I think incredibly revealing to see all of the guys who made millions of dollars by being against that just totally embrace it. One second later, that right now, if you are critical of the way Israel is conducting, like, just imagine, you're critical. First of all, it's a war of choice, like objectively speaking. It's not that Israel was invaded and had to defend themselves. Like, some prisoners broke out and killed some people and ran back into their prison. You could say they have an obligation to do what they can to get the hostages back, but this certainly isn't the way to do that. But imagine like criticizing a war of choice against a captive people that don't have a military, you know, like criticizing that is equated to hating Jewish people. It's that, you know, it's as dumb as anything you've ever heard out of the woke left. And so
it's also really quite anti-Semitic, actually, to conflate all Jewish people like you have to be associated with this state government that's committing atrocities in your, and I see this done all the time where, yeah, if you're criticizing Israel, the ergo, all Jewish people must be associated with Israel, ergo, you're criticizing Jewish people. And that kind of like blanket characterization of any demographic group of people, like that's kind of the textbook definition of racism.
Yeah, it's the only people who agree with that are Benjamin Netanyahu and the Jew haters. Like the actual anti-Semites agree with the Zionists on this.
That's right.
That yes,
right.
This does speak for all Jews. And, you know, there's always been this very weird symbiotic relationship between Jew haters and Zionists. And, you know, this is why the Stern Gang met with the Nazis and they wanted to ally with the Nazis during World War II. And it's only because the Nazis hated Jews so much that it didn't happen, which is kind of funny in a dark way.
Can you explain that? Because we learned that in Daryl's podcast.
Daryl Cooper.
But can you lay that out for people? Because it is an astonishing fact.
Yeah, people don't know this.
So the Stern Gang, if you're not aware, they were one of the militias in Palestine before the creation of Israel that then got incorporated into the IDF when Israel was created. And they were the most vicious ones. And they were all pretty vicious. But they were like, they were self-described terrorists. Like they engaged in terrorism with the stated goal of driving out an occupying force. Let that irony sink in for a little bit, that as if this is like some crazy argument that Israelis could, oh, that's not, occupation doesn't lead to terrorism. It was like, that's literally what you guys said. So anyway, during a little bit before that, during the run-up to World War II, they met at least on one occasion with Nazis to try to form a partnership. And the reason was, when you think about it, kind of obvious that the Nazis, this is before, you know, the Nazis went genocidal. The Nazis at the time, their stated goal was to drive all of Jews out of Europe. And the Zionist goal was to get all of the Jews to come to Palestine. And so they saw it and they were like, well, hey, we got a perfect partnership here. We both want the same
thing. There for you.
Yeah. I mean, like the worst imaginable horseshoe theory. But even before the rise of the Nazis, this was always, the Zionists always weirdly had mutual interests with the rise of anti-Semitism. And you can see that even now today, right? Like it's
right.
the more people that are out there saying horrible things about Jews, that's not like, you know, if I'm having a debate with Dennis Prager, that's not a point for me. That's a point that hurts my case, but it's a point that helps his case because he can go, look at how much we're hated. And that's why we have to do what we have to do.
That's why we have to have Israel. And as Joe Biden says, if there is no Israel, no Jew anywhere can be safe.
Right. Right. You have to kind of live in this world as if the state of Western civilization today is similar to the state of Nazi Germany, which is, you know, totally absurd. But so they always kind of had this relationship where they wanted to see a rise in anti-Semitism in Europe because they wanted more Jews to come to Palestine. And, ultimately, that is what happened.
Dave, talk to me about, you mentioned in that debate, you don't like to use the word genocide applied to the Gaza Strip. Just give, is that like a philosophical thing
or
you don't think it meets the definition or you feel like that's tactically better not to use that language? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I guess there's a bit of both to it. So strategically speaking, when you go into these debates, it always devolves into a debate over semantics. And like, mm-hmm. That's not really the debate I care to have. Like, I don't really care what you call it. I'm here to argue that this is wrong and horrific and needs to stop. There's the word genocide. It conjures up images of something that isn't exactly what's happening in Gaza right now. Like
it conjures up the Holocaust.
It's that everyone thinks the Holocaust or the Armenian genocide or like what Stalin did to the Ukrainians, which I guess is a little bit more similar to this. But you know, the international definition of genocide is like so incredibly vague and it's just like, I don't know. I just don't, it's like, I'm not like offended when people use the word. I don't even care to get into all of these debates. It's not, I'm a libertarian, like a very radical libertarian. I don't believe in government authority at all. I don't actually care what the UN decided the international definition of genocide is. What I care about is human beings having their rights violated. I care about what's moral and what's immoral. And to me, this is horrifically wrong. And I'm just, I feel like I'm a lawyer and I've got this guy dead to rights on this charge of this is morally wrong. So let me just prosecute that case and not worry about getting into, like, you know, arguments about interpretations of international law.
So in other words, at like the International Criminal Court, for example, you would say a stronger charge to bring is like, hey, I'm making up dates here, but hey, on November 12th, you guys bombed this hospital and this clinic and this vehicle, which had five civilians in it. And here are the bodies and here's the evidence. And this is what you're being charged with. And these are the penalties, right? So in other words, you would rather get down into the micro specific examples versus the broad title, because it's harder to argue against the specifics of the actual crimes themselves versus a label like genocide.
The way I look at it is like this. And this is an argument that comes from Lysander Spooner, who is like a brilliant anarchist thinker. And he basically argued that the Constitution of the United States of America has no authority over any of us, because we never agreed to it. We never signed it. We never, like, there's, we never actually, like, in, it's not a contract that we voluntarily entered into. But he would argue that the United States government is ruled by that document, because they all do swear an oath to uphold it. So, like, you made the choice to enter into this contract. So in the same way, I think international law is all imaginary and it doesn't really exist. I like it as a tool to point out that, hey, government of Israel, you agreed to these rules and you're not following them. But the reality of the situation is that when you go to a high enough level of power, there is no such thing as law. And the entire new world order, international, you know, the whole liberal world order that was created in the wake of World War II was specifically created so that the United States of America could become the global empire, and that we don't have to follow international law. And you see this blatantly. I mean, like, the U.S. violates international law all the time. Israel violates international law all the time. And that's just too bad. We're allowed to do it. That's the way it works. International law is a tool for the powerful to impose on the less powerful. So we will stop someone else from violating international law unless you are on the side of the empire.
But you would want to see it equally applied, right? You'd want to see it fairly applied and to have the laws enforced against both the US and Israel, et cetera.
What I want to see is moral outcomes. So whatever the means to get there might be, I mean, like, whoever has the power to do so, yes, I'd like to see countries or governments, I should say, I wouldn't like to see them not be allowed to occupy and indiscriminately kill innocent civilians. And if there was a way to achieve that through international law, then sure, that would be better than what we have right now.
I don't disagree with certainly with the fact that the U.S. is totally hypocritical. I mean, you can see it very blatantly with the way they talk about what Russia's doing in Ukraine. You know, not, they can say genocide, they can say war crime. It's not hard. Putin's a war criminal. Then when it's Israel, it's like, what is it? What even is a war crime? Who could really say? We're going to do an investigation and we'll get back to you. I mean, and this is just the most recent example right there. We could go back throughout the history of this, you know, post-World War II order and point out many, many more. Like you, I find it useful as a tool, though, because even though the leaders were full of shit, like the people generally bought into this idea. You know, that's why they still use the humanitarian language, because people feel like you and I do of like, no, we'd like to see certain things be off the table. We'd like to feel like, you know, we're the good guys the way we were in World War II, stopping a genocide and being on the right side of history. We like the idea of there are certain things that are acts of, you know, acts against humanity, crimes against humanity that should be completely banned. And so when you have somewhat of an international consensus forming around the fact of like, it's at least plausibly a genocide, that's at least potentially the case, and you've got the UN, you know, special rapporteur from human rights saying, hey, there's reasonable grounds, and you now have a majority of Biden voters saying, yeah, it looks like a genocide to us. It's not that I expect the officials to be consistent, but I think their hypocrisy is in and of itself a useful tool. of, okay, you, because Joe Biden can't come out and say, actually, I do support genocides and I was just full of shit. He has to keep up the farce. And so that's what makes it a difficult situation for him and why I do find the word to be useful in this context.
Yeah, look, I mean, that's a fair argument. I pretty much agree with all of that. I and certainly there's a benefit to using the word and there's a cost to using the word. I get your point there. I can't really argue with any of that. I just say I'm just going to continue to prosecute the case that it is horrific what's happening.
So I was going to say final thing on my end. I don't know if you have something you want to.
Yeah, I've got one more.
If it's on this, it's not you go ahead. Okay. I'm just going to wrap up with some.
I wanted to hear a little bit more of your thoughts from a libertarian perspective of, you know, you said your thing is just you want to see moral acts and not immoral acts. What from a libertarian perspective is the way that that would be enforced in your ideal world system, et cetera?
Well, I mean, really, like all that has to happen is that America has to stop propping this up. I mean, it would have been there would be no possible way that Israel could behave the way they do without the U.S. signing off on it. So we're essentially removing one government program away from basically solving the problem. Israel would be forced to negotiate and they would be forced to find some type of peace. And this is, you know, there's always, this is also true throughout the entire history of Israel, that this has always been the dynamic, is that there were reasonable voices within the Zionist movement, but then they had all of the backing of international financing. And so they didn't have to listen to those reasonable voices because we had they had such an incredible advantage over their Arab inhabitants of the land. And so that's, to me, the obvious libertarian solution to this is to get our government out of the way of funding and propping up Israel and protecting them internationally. And that would put enormous pressure on them. It's the same thing in the situation in Ukraine, where they literally were ready to make a deal. Mm. And then the Biden administration comes in and goes, we will fund you till the end of time if you don't make this deal. And of course, there's tremendous perverse incentives there because it's not just, oh, we'll fund your war effort, as there's been a ton of reporting on. It's like the powerful people in Ukraine who are making this decision are, this money's going into their bank accounts. Like they're just getting bribed off to continue fighting this war. And they're not fighting and dying in it. They're conscripting young men to go fight and die in it. That's a very similar dynamic in Israel. So I'd say the libertarian solution would be to get our government out of propping up Israel.
I don't know, Dave. I think you're just a self-hating Jew personally. That is
the conclusion.
All right. So my last question, Dave, and correct me if I'm wrong, you called yourself a radical libertarian. Is that the terminology you used or was it a different word?
I'd say I think that's a good description. Yeah. No, that's what I just said right now. I mean, yes, I would. Okay. I mean, I would like to see nothing short of a revolution in this country. So I think that's pretty radical.
So, I've read the whole libertarian canon. I've read Hayek. I've read von Mises. I've read a bunch of Ayn Rand. Which flavor of libertarian are you? Because I've even seen arguments, I think it was Rand who made the argument of like, any sort of public system, like a court system, for example, or police system, like even that she would have like voluntarily funded by the wealthy. So in other words, like no form of taxation in any way, shape or form, not even a 1% or 2% flat tax or, you know, tax, sales tax or whatever. How deep does it go? And I know that we're opening up a whole can of worms here. We can have you on again and we can get into other like economic stuff if you'd like. But I'm just curious, which flavor of libertarian are you? Because there's such a wide array of versions of libertarian.
Yeah, well, I think Mises is the most brilliant economist to ever live. I completely agree with him on all things economic. I'm a Rothbardian, you know, more like in the Ron Paul school of libertarians. I'm not a huge Ayn Rand fan. And I don't like Hayek at all. Look, the answer essentially to me is that like, yeah, ideally you would have a voluntary society. That would be the ideal way to organize society and that it wouldn't, there's no reason why. Look, if you really think about the nature of government, what it is a collection of services. And whether it's protection services or, you know, whatever the government policy may be. And that if you're looking at this like, okay, well, these services have to be funded. Now, how should they be funded? Should they be funded because the people who get these services provided to them choose to purchase them, or should they be funded with the threat of we will throw you in a cage if you don't fund these? Yes, ideally, the morally correct answer there would be that they were voluntarily funded. That being said, I'm not going to like fight against a 1% or 2% income tax. That would be a big improvement over what we have. I'm not sure we'll ever get to the point where we do live in a completely voluntary society, but I would like to move as close to that direction as possible.
You are a dirty reformist. You are no revolutionary.
Dave Smith, a 1% income tax.
How dare you?
Outrageous.
We're going to get you to support unions next. Jesus Christ.
I support private unions, not public unions, though.
There's a libertarian argument for unions for sure. That's actually requires
that's
them less
of,
government power if you have like local bargaining committee. And then,
but that's interesting. Most libertarians I've come across are anti-union, but well, this is a longer conversation for another day.
Well, I'll just say that the libertarian position is to you have to oppose public sector unions, because it's a different thing to have workers get together to collectively negotiate, because we have more negotiating power when we're together than when we're just individuals. It's a whole different thing, you know, because in that dynamic, it's like the workers want to get paid more, the boss wants to pay them less. So, okay, you kind of are negotiating what a better deal. In the case of public sector unions, you have a bunch of government employees getting together, arguing with the government about how much of other people's money they should give them. In which case, this just ends with the politician going, sure, I'll give you more of other people's money. And this is why there's so much corruption in every public sector union. So that I oppose.
Gotcha. Well, we'll save the debate for another time. That would be a fun one, though, if we get into economic stuff. I would enjoy that very much. But Dave, thank you so much for joining us, man. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, really enjoyed it, Dave.
Plug all your stuff for everybody, too.
Oh, well, thank you guys very much. I really enjoyed it. ComicDaveSmith.com is my website. If you want to see where I'm going to be, I tour all over the country. So if you want to come see me, check me out there. And then at Comic Dave Smith on Twitter, my podcast is, as it says behind me, Part of the Problem. And thanks again, guys. I really enjoyed it.
All right. That was Dave Smith. Very interesting conversation. We should actually have him on again to go into like economics.
Yeah,
and just have
fun.
A friendly debate, because he seems like one to not take disagreements personally.
Definitely.
Which is big for this space. You know, some people get all in their feelings when you disagree. Oh, how dare you? I'm never coming back on. Here's a 27 tweet thread against you. You know what I mean?
I'm so forgiving of anyone at this point who's on the right side on this
issue. That's funny.
I'll forgive a lot of things.
But on the libertarian side, there's a lot of good conversation to have there.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, I mean, in his ideal, he would like a voluntary society in terms of funding the basic necessities. But, you know, the big objection to that, which I didn't want to get in because we could have gone for another hour, 2 hours that, is that it would only be the wealthy who fund the courts. It would only be the wealthy who fund the police. And then the courts and the police are going to be totally biased in favor of the wealthy to the point of absurdity, right? And then you have a peasant fucking overclass society, which is in theory the thing that you're trying to avoid if you're creating a society that's voluntary like that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Sort of like the old company towns like West Virginia, where like the courts and the police and the schools and the housing and everything is like run by the mine operators.
Right. Yeah. Being.
Yeah. I mean, there's anyway, we'll save the libertarian debate for another day, because
it's a fun one, though.
It's a fun one. We had that great debate with the libertarian Mike Tremont.
Yeah, but
that was fun.
But Dave is more substantive than that guy.
That was a good conversation.
It was a good conversation, but Dave can handle his own better, I think, than that guy.
He's very skilled. I mean, that's one of the things that we were talking off camera. It's great to have, like, his comedian skills. Not only is he a great communicator, but he has a way of sort of summing things up. That's what came through in the debate. And also, comedians are great observers of the absurdities in society, and that's such an important skill in all of this as well.
Yeah, there's a communication X factor ability that's super important for people who are in the public eye, and virtually every comedian has that. I don't know if I've ever seen a comedian that doesn't have some X factor in terms of ability to communicate.
Oh, you know? Yeah. That's I can't imagine. That's so hard to stand up in front of a room of people and make them laugh.
It's fun.
Crazy.
I've done one semi stand-up routine in my life. I was the best man at my friend's wedding.
Yeah.
Plotted out a whole little.
You did a whole set?
I did a whole stand-up routine. I did a whole set. And first of all, I understand why they do it. It is fucking addicting. When you get the laughter, It's like a drug.
Mm.
If people are laughing, you're like, I made that happen, bro. It feels good. It feels really good. But the thing that I found interesting about it is all the lines that I thought would hit and make them laugh didn't. And all my throwaway lines made them laugh.
Huh.
So I was like, oh my God, there's like a science to this shit.
Yeah.
You know, I thought this line was a guaranteed winner and it was fucking crickets, but the next throwaway line, they all...
Well, that's why even the best, I mean, they have to go out and try the material
out, see what works,
workshop it, tweak
it. Only like the best of the best can know up front. Like I bet like Dave Chappelle or somebody like that knows up front when I say this, they're going
to
laugh.
It'd be interesting to know if they feel like they know right away when they write a joke, like, oh, this is going to hit.
Well, we talked about that. Remember the other day in the car,
music.
We were talking about that with music.
Yeah.
Because there's this guy, I think, what's his name? Mike Miller, is it? The guy who made all the beats. Max Miller. Mike Miller is the fucking State Department ghoul. Jesus Christ. That's,
right? No, that's Matthew Miller.
Matthew Miller. Okay. Sorry. Anyway, there's this one guy who made all like the number one hit banging ass songs for like the past 20 years.
Yeah, producer.
Like we went and looked at the list. It was like, geez, every song I like this
Brittany
guy made.
Brittany and Taylor. Right? And Ariana.
And it's
yeah.
like, I wonder for the artist, do you know, hey, I just made a banger that's going to be number one on the charts? Or is it just like, I don't fucking know. Throw it out there. See what happens.
Yeah.
You know?
My guess is that it's kind of similar to, you know, when we put out a clip on YouTube.
You have a vague idea, but you don't know.
Yeah. Sometimes you pretty much know, like, oh, these names are in the title. I crushed it with the title, the thumbnail. Like, there's no way this doesn't pop off, barring YouTube, like, blocking it or whatever.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you
are surprised.
Sometimes one that you think is going to be a day and you're just doing it because you're like, this is important and I'm going to do it. Will totally pop off. And sometimes one that you think is going to be like, you feel like, oh, this will probably do well. It's kind of like a dud. So,
it's
I
like
mean,
a mixed bag.
It is a mixed bag. Sometimes you do. So that's what I guess is like, sometimes they know like, oh, there's no way this isn't popular. But just like with the YouTube algorithm, some of it is alchemy. Some of it's not just merit. It's like, well, does it get played and does it happen to, you know, pop at the right
and
moment?
The argument happening right now in like the hip hop world where you got Drake versus like 1,000 people.
Yeah.
Is like the argument from all the people who are against Drake are like, you're totally fucking manufactured. Like, you're not organically the guy. You've been made the guy because of your relationship with the industry and how they pump your shit out. That's basically the heart of the argument, which we don't need to get into all that right now. But I'm a Drake hater, but I think he's holding his own in this fight with Kendrick and all the rest of them. Anyway, we'll end it on that.
I think for you to be as big as Drake, it's not just manufactured.
I disagree.
Because
they can manufacture somebody. Like, Joe Biden is fucking president. You're telling me they can't manufacture some shit? This motherfucker never would have won in a fair system. Get him off the stage.
There's no electoral college of the music industry. Like,
it's nothing
but electoral college. It has to be that, you know, yes, it's pumped a lot, but also people genuinely, then they were like, I like this. I'm going to listen to it. Like, you can't, I mean, this is somebody, he's had like the most number ones of any whatever. Like, I'm not even a huge Drake fan, but it can't be that it's just manufactured. Clearly, people like his music organically.
The question is, how far can pushing somebody get them to the top of the mountain? That's the question.
Yeah.
And I think you would concede that it can certainly get you, at the very least, a few number one hits.
Yeah.
Right?
But Drake is way beyond a few number one hits.
I understand that.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, if you agree that it could get you at least a few number one hits, then it's in the realm of possibility you could push somebody to being like the guy.
Nah, I don't really agree with that. I think it could probably get you to be like a one-hit wonder. Like one hit.
I think it can go further than that, believe it or not. You might be right that it can't get you like 20 number one hits and you're the guy in the industry for 10 or 20 years.
Yeah.
You're probably right about that. But I think with just a push, you can probably get somebody, you know, to be number one for 3 years, 4 years, something like that, you know?
I don't buy it.
But look, this is all a moot point anyway.
People
because
like what
said,
they like, you know?
I'm a Drake hater, but I thought he's doing great in this battle with Kendrick. His diss track was fire. I liked it. And Kendrick hasn't said shit back yet.
That he still hasn't responded.
No. But that's how he works. He takes years before he releases shit, usually.
Mm.
Whereas Drake was like, oh, you diss me? Next day, here, bitch. I don't actually know if it was the next day. It was within the next few days.
Yeah.
And they released another diss track with fucking AI Tupac. That was hard. With AI Tupac and fucking AI Snoop Dogg. I wonder how Snoop Dogg felt about that.
True.
Snoop Dogg's like, I'm alive. You can't use my AI voice. I don't want to be in this beef, you know?
Maybe he does. It's nice for his relevance, right? Yeah, this is what, when I'm falling asleep at night, this is what I hear Kyle over there listening to. Not only the track, but then
stuff.
Like,
it's this, it's golf stuff. It's fucking, I watch a million things.
True.
Anyway.
All right.
All right, guys. Everybody sign up on Substack. What are you doing with your life? It's below. You know, pay $5 a month. Get the video a day earlier. You could sign up for free. Get the audio version a day later. Love you all, and we'll talk to you later. Peace.